The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting over in Oprah's intention section. Oprah on finding your path forward. You all know that I believe failure is just the universe moving us in a different direction. This article is by Oprah Winfrey. Happy February! It's still the beginning of the year in my book, a time to make changes and start anew. But what to do when you don't know what to do? You all know that I believe failure is just the universe moving us in a different direction. So, I don't often feel stuck. But during the launch of the OWN own cable network, whoa, that was something else. For 2 long years, I wrestled with my decision. I kept running through the what ifs. What if I'd done this instead of that? What if I'd waited a little longer? What if I had one more conversation? That's right. I spent 2 full years resisting the decision that I had made. I was really stuck. I know now, and part of me even knew then, that the way forward starts with taking stock. How did I get here? What choices brought me to this place? Because no one ends up anywhere by accident. Sometimes we end up there after a breakup, a job loss, the death of a loved one. Sometimes, as we've seen so clearly these past few weeks, it's a natural disaster, a fire, a flood, a tornado, that demolishes our plans. And sometimes we're not even sure how it happened. That's why we've created a guided journal, Oprah's The Life You Want Becoming Unstuck Journal, to help anyone in this situation find their own path. It's got expert advice and exercises, writing prompts, and inspiration to help you take the first steps into a brighter, freer future. What are you working through right now? Whatever it is, I hope this journal launches you or someone else you know in the right direction. Go well this week, everyone. We're moving over into wholeness now. How to trust your gut post-trauma. One writer learns how to listen to her body first, not her mind. This article is by Kira Van Eickel. I am in the heart of the Berkshire Mountains in Massachusetts. It is the end of October, and the tree-covered hills around me are a riot of orange, red, and yellow. There's a lake just over the hill I'm on that doesn't look like a body of water, so much as like a million glistening starbursts, reflecting an unseasonably warm sun. Add a tastefully neutral cashmere cardigan and a steaming cup of coffee, and I'd be in the perfect Folgers ad for the late 1970s. And yet, I'm a little jumpy. I approach a labyrinth of open pathways and read the plaque at its entrance, inviting visitors to enter with no agenda, to enjoy simply wandering in the present. Even with that benign welcome, I must circle the outside of the labyrinth first to see it from all angles. I like to case things and people before I commit. My monkey mind jumps to the rest of the vast property I've landed at for a week-long retreat. I want a map so that I can find some trails, but I quickly realize I'm too embarrassed to ask for a map, in case that is not the vibey present thing one is supposed to do. I am 5'10" with broad, straight shoulders and long legs. I am strong, in theory. I am smart enough. I'm socially adept enough. but I am scared of the labyrinth and scared to ask for a map. I am also scared of being alone for the next 5 nights, which is an embarrassing admission, because writers are supposed to love the solitary life. When I am alone, I feel restless and worried, as if the void will swallow me whole. Very few people know this about me. They see a social animal who loves people and laughing and dancing and seems totally unafraid. Being fun and lovable and loving has served me well. I believe that it has kept me safe. So what happens when I think of the room at the top of the hill where I will sleep alone, and the breakfast where I'll know no one, and worse, not know the rules of breakfast? My breath catches. My chest and abdomen seize up, and like most of these days, I quickly pick up my phone to quell it all. I am what I like to call a high-functioning person with a little residual trauma. This is not easy for me to say, because since 18, I've been very invested in not being a traumatized person. I've worked hard for it. When I was very little, I vacillated between screaming meltdowns and a state of disassociation wherein mind and body separated totally. I have memories from around age 9 of hallucinating while bobbing in an ocean. Suddenly, I couldn't feel anything but the unbearable, endless enormity of the sea, and I didn't exist anymore and almost sank. Another time, I was riding a bike, and the handlebar became giant, so giant that my hands could no longer grip it. I fell off, and no one knew why. I tripped and fell a lot. I napped a lot. I read books the way kids today play video games, so intensely, feverishly, that my parents had to restrict them at night. I was often in trouble. Adults seemed exasperated with me, and friends came and went. I also thought I was bad and stupid and banged my head against the wall. I was too emotional, too excitable, too angry. I accepted these traits as hard facts by about age 3. Another thing I knew beyond the shadow of a doubt was that when my mother's adopted brother entered my house I was in, it was bad news for me, and there was no way to escape. This is the moment where I put you at ease and reassure you that I am not broken, that I am okay, and you don't have to worry or feel uncomfortable in the slightest. As I said, I've worked hard for it, for normal. I no longer disassociate. I don't bang my head against the wall. All my past trauma and PTSD have been neatly solved and tucked away with great therapy and the love of family and friends. I understand the past, and it doesn't affect me. These are my standard lines, and I mean them. It's just I really cannot be alone, and I really like detailed instructions to things ahead of time, that's all. So why am I in the mountains avoiding the labyrinth? These are the grounds of the famed Kripalu Center, an equal parts beautiful and no-frills yoga and wellness destination. And I am joining over 300 attendees for a week-long retreat called the Wisdom of Trauma Healing Immersion, led by Dr. Peter A. Levine, Dr. Gabor Mate, that's M-A-T-E with an accent marked over the E, and Dr. Scott Lyons, with Dr. Bessel van der Kolk as a featured guest. Picture a week with Taylor Swift, Beyonce, and Billie Eilish, with Charlie XCX as your host. That's what this is like for those of us versed in the books, podcasts, and TED Talks featuring the marquee names here. It wasn't always thus. When Levine, Mate, and van der Kolk, all in their 80s now, each started their groundbreaking work, they were all variously shunned by their peers in the field. Today, trauma is common parlance, recognized as impacting not just individuals and families, but entire systems of existence, countries, and cultures. On the flip side, the word has also reached peak overuse with TikToks on how to get over a traumatizing hairdryer mishap or the trauma of a B+. The brain trust assembled here is clear about what isn't trauma. Disappointment, a twisted ankle, a breakup. At the same time, they expand our often limited parameters of what is. We now understand that in addition to big T traumatic events, abuse, war, violence, racism, addiction, less obvious things such as distance or narcissistic parenting, social ostracism and bullying also leave a mark. Perhaps most critically, they explain that it isn't the trauma itself that affects our daily lives, but the belief system that arises from the event, which in turn becomes the prism through which we perceive our lives. As Mattei boils it down as only he can, it's not so much the blow as the concussion. In trying to make sense of the trauma we've experienced and trying to prevent it from happening again, we might start to believe that we are unlovable, bad, guilty, undeserving, or stupid. And as those beliefs ossify, adaptations evolve, avoidance, addictions, low self-esteem, depression, rage. It's as if one foot has been tied down to a cement block, and when we try mightily to step forward, we just do an awkward dance around that stuck foot. It is only when we start to dissolve those beliefs that we revert to a natural state of goodness, of deserving air, food, and love. A state where the harmful behaviors and addictions no longer serve. At this retreat, the method we're learning for casting off those adaptive habits is the somatic approach, an umbrella term for modalities that integrate awareness of the body with the mind. The idea is that when we learn the language of our reactions, how the physical and emotional and mental are all communicating with one another, we begin to choose which reactions are useful. It takes practice, and for many, it can be deeply uncomfortable to do. But as all the speakers emphatically repeat, freedom lies in the gap we can start to develop between any given stimulus and old patterns of reaction. The arc of our week is intentional. It begins with talks that define trauma and its roots, then moves on to how we manifest it, and finally ends with pathways to healing. The days are long and intense, and I am grateful for Kripalu as the vessel, the simple but nourishing and warming food, the optional yoga classes, the 15-minute breaks in which I seek out the Adirondack chairs scattered around on the hill. I make a point of walking down to the lake every morning. The uphill walk back is a good physical clearing for the day ahead. My room, clean and unadorned, is exactly what I need when I crash into bed after the last talk ends at 9 p.m. every night. 2 days in, I realize I am on a wondrous journey with four distinct sages as my guides. Peter Levine is the kindly grandfather, creator of somatic experiencing, an author or co-author of 8 books, including the groundbreaking 1997 Waking the Tiger, and his most recent, an autobiography of trauma. Gabor Mate is the author or co-author of 6 books on topics as varied as the origins of ADD, scattered minds, how the body expresses trauma, when the body says no, and 2022's The Myth of Normal, co-written with his son, Daniel Mate. A Hungarian Holocaust survivor, he calls to mind Loki, the Norse god of mischief, as he uses his method of compassionate inquiry to interrogate people's old beliefs. When he sits in a chair, he often slips off his shoes and perches, cross-legged, not unlike some wild guru. Levine, too, slips off his shoes, but his stance is a more relaxed, receiving mode. Bessel van der Kolk, researcher and author of the best-selling The Baby Keeps the Score, Shoes Off, too, is like a jolly Santa Claus. With white beard, belly and all, when his attention turns to you, his eyes twinkle, and he laughs gently to put you at ease and encourage you to keep going. Scott Lyons, creator of the Embody Lab, a resource for somatic learning and author of Addicted to Drama, is almost two generations younger. In marked contrast to the slightly rumpled professional garb of the other three, he wears wide-legged jeans, a Cartier bracelet, and an artfully perforated sweater. He's a comedian and deftly deploys the memeified language of millennials and Gen Z. I find out later that he performed drag comedy through college, and it tracks. We open his sessions with play, tossing giant red balls across the room. It breaks the ice, yes, but it also situates us in our bodies. Though their approaches differ, they share a deeply held commitment to restoring mind-body connection through attention and care. In a Q&A session with Matei, a woman says, "I don't feel I deserve to be here. Like, who do I think I am?" Matei gently stops her there and turns the question on its head. What do you think you are? Are you someone who got herself here? And the woman realizes that in spite of feeling undeserving, she has enough resilience and belief in herself to have made all the plans to be here with us at Kripalu. Later, when Matei talks about the importance of having a clear connection to our gut instinct so as to live by a true internal compass, I feel like the head of the class. My gut is always firing, as in, do not enter the labyrinth, as in, to ensure my survival, I need to figure out everything and everybody in advance. When I ask Matei about it, he cocks his head and looks at me with empathy. I have mistaken hypervigilance, a response to the belief I am in constant danger for gut instinct. The more you're in touch with your gut, the less fear you have to feel, because the gut feelings are there to protect you, he says. What if you were 100% in connection with your gut feelings and you trusted them? You could rely on yourself in the moment to know when there's danger and when there isn't. Right. So, simple. But it takes me until this moment to understand that there's a big difference between feeling so ashamed and afraid that you're bracing for threats everywhere and knowing that you are lovable and safe enough to trust that gut. A really, really big one. In Levine's demonstrations, he illustrates how simple awareness of body language tells us where to begin. A young woman describes feeling so overwhelmed by a needy parent that she shuts down. He asks her what it feels like in her body. She replies that it is a giant no. He asks her what that looks like, and she juts her arm out with her hand up like a traffic cop. Together, over the course of the next half hour, they slowly transform the rigid physical response by using movement and even sound and his trademark roar, a deep, vibrating voo sound we all try and I love for its calming and joyous effect. The takeaway? When we know what our body is telling us about our needs and wants, our boundaries don't need to be fortress-like to be strong. On day three, Lyons stands at the front of the room with a thick sheaf of white paper between his hands. Without warning, he throws it into the air and the individual sheets land all around him. This, he tells us, is the disintegration of self that occurs after a traumatic event. As he speaks, he begins to contort his towering former dancer's body on the floor, moving from sheet to sheet as if in an advanced game of Twister. With one arm stretched onto one sheet, back arched into a bridge, and one leg in the air seeking out another sheet, he explains breathlessly and hilariously that this is the hard work of the person trying to keep it all together. We are laughing. It is physical comedy, but it's heartbreaking too as we recognize the exhaustion of holding a twister pose at all times. I think of all the ways I do this in my life, keeping old dangers at bay by trying to be lovable and good to all constituencies, and inevitably failing. And I think of that poor little kid I left in the dust as soon as I could. Lyons and Levine both emphasize repeatedly that the practice isn't to go crashing right into your traumatic event, but to create what Lyons calls architectures of support, to get that sheaf of paper back into one place, that parts holding everything down have to feel safe enough. To that end, we're asked to conjure a beautiful memory. Mine is holding my children as babies and toddlers. I feel effervescent and suffused with warm light. I know this is joy and calm, and I also know that simply by evoking it, I have access to it. It is real. Once that is established, it is safer ground from which to explore more difficult terrain. It could be as benign as noticing how and when your shoulders hunch, or your throat tightens, or starting to recognize that when anger arises underneath, it might actually be a sensation linked to hurt. Once we recognize those moments, we can start to be aware of thoughts that give rise to the feelings and the beliefs that inform those thoughts, and then choice enters the picture. If, as Levine says, trauma is the past imposing itself on the present, then by bringing attention to our body's response, we gain the agency to act in the present. It makes so much sense, but is far easier said than done. How do we do it? Practice and patience and support and compassion. By the time I leave Kripalu, I have had small wins. The notion of creating space between an event and a response reverberates for me. In my adult life, I've perfected responses that played a lot better than the outbursts of the scared, feral child. Be smooth and unflappable for maximum lovability, but it left me suppressing too many things while others burst out sideways, like misplaced anger and recurrent debilitating back pain. I always loved Keanu Reeves as Neo in The Matrix and his ability to slow down bullets so that dodging them is a breeze. I craved that super skill. The difference now is that I understood that the goal is not to dodge the bullets. It is to have the space, the internal time, however you want to characterize it, to understand that the bullets are not there. My job is to notice how my body responds in good and bad moments and name it, and, with enough compassion, maybe even soothe it, to show it that we are in the present, on a beautiful hill overlooking a shimmering lake, and we are tall and strong and safe, that I am not being hunted by a predator three times my size. In the month since the retreat, I've been my own personal lab rat. Again and again, I snatch that little moment, that ever-widening shaft of light between an event and my old reactions. I've even found myself using Levine's voo sound, a sort of low, buzzy hum that stimulates the vagus nerve and brings fairly instant calm. Instead of tensing, I welcome a funny, dear, unexpected little giggle. This feels safe. If I'm not so busy with arms and legs in a pretzel trying to cover up unlikable things, trying to keep them together for an imaginary, perfect way to survive, then there is a sudden surfeit of time, of grace, of safety, and most surprising of all, the laughter of a child free and deserving of love. We're heading into the relationships section. How to support a teenager through a breakup. In her new book, First Love, Guiding Teens Through Relationships and Heartbreak, Lisa A. Phillips shares the do's and don'ts of post-breakup parenting. This article is by Lisa A. Phillips. My mother recently reminded me of the time I lay on her bedroom floor crying and telling her I couldn't bear to be alive. "Which time?" I said wryly. We laughed together because it happened 40 years ago, enough distance for me to mock myself. I did remember that time. I was 16, and my boyfriend had gone off to college and gotten himself a new girlfriend without telling me. But I would feel that bad several more times, the kind of bad no parent wants their child ever to feel. The excruciating nature of romantic rejection, a subject I've been writing about for years, remained so vivid to me that nearly from the moment my daughter started seeing her first boyfriend, I worried about the moment it would end. For many teens, breakups are their first significant experience of loss. Yet they often contend with messages that the feelings they're going through don't quite count. We tend to remind young people of their youth and opportunities and urge them to move on. If a relationship was short or took place mainly or entirely online, young people have even less permission to be thrown by the loss. Even though a relationship of messaging and video calls for hours a day can be just as intense as a face-to-face relationship or more, given the added charge of imagination and possibility. If you've been anticipating for months what it will be like to finally meet your beloved, then realizing that you never will is agonizing. Being told your relationship wasn't real in the first place doesn't help. Adult efforts to minimize teen breakup pain contribute to a phenomenon known as disenfranchised grief. Breakup grief has many of the same qualities as bereavement: despair, anger, guilt, obsessive thinking, loss of control. Without the socially recognized right to grieve, it's worse for queer youth, who may find a breakup puts them at odds with the small, tightly knit, vulnerable social circles that still categorize much of LGBTQ+ high school social life. If they can't speak openly and safely about the split at home, their isolation increases. Disenfranchised grief also tends to be more trying for boys, who suffer just as much and just as long after a breakup as girls. But boys may not get as much support as girls, given entrenched social mores that discourage males from expressing sadness and strong emotions. Nancy Darling, a psychology professor at Oberlin College, points out that romantic relationships tend to be the most supportive relationships teen boys have for expressing emotion, while teen girls often have richer networks of friends to confide in. Boys fall in love faster, and they fall in love harder, Darling told me. After a breakup, they've just lost what is probably their most intimate relationship. What to say? What can parents do to foster productive reflection in their children, the kind of talk that helps rebuild and potentially redeem the self in the wake of a breakup? The first steps are admittedly delicate ones, given teen sensitivity to invasions of privacy. Just start out by saying, "I'm sorry," and simply asking them how they're doing, Darling said. If you're quiet and don't grill them, hopefully they'll talk. If you grill them, they'll shut up. She advises allowing young people time and space to grieve while continuing to create opportunities for conversation. The idea is to be next to them, doing something dull such as a car ride or household chores, which may lead them to feel like talking. They still might not say much. This in itself isn't reason to worry. Some may prefer confiding in peers or writing in a journal. Some may just need to take to their beds and hide. They may not seem to need you, but your presence is still meaningful, sending the message that their heartbreak is worthy of attention. Don't try to get a young person to talk by bringing up your own romantic past. While many young people have told me that they appreciated learning about their parents' early relationships and how they ended, save this kind of disclosure for another time. The wake of a breakup is about the child, not the parent. Unless they ask, young people won't want to hear about how a parent rose from the ashes of a disastrous split when they're dealing with one themselves. There are some parents for whom this is going to trigger bad memories of their own adolescent romantic history, said Lawrence Steinberg, a Temple University psychology professor and author of several books about adolescent development. How you felt when you were broken up with is probably not relevant to how your kid feels right now. Resist the temptation to say, "This happened to me." If and when young people do discuss their breakup, listen to how they tell the story. Are they casting the split in moral absolutes, that they were the victims of an evil, unfeeling ex? Are they saying the relationship ended because they aren't attractive or interesting enough? Black and white thinking can't validate the complexity of what's just happened or capitalize on the potential for growth. Northwestern University professor Alexandra Solomon preaches the power of fostering a thick narrative about the breakup. Recounting the story of a relationship and its ending with nuance and detail. If teens say an ex sucks, a classic adolescent plant, Solomon advises that parents ask why. They can prompt teens toward a more comprehensive understanding of what happened with such statements as, "It sounds like you were working hard to figure things out, and they just weren't able to respond." Sudden or unexplained breakups leave teens with a gaping hole in their breakup story. When I brought this up with Solomon, one of our many conversations about love over the years, she acknowledged what a raw deal this is. Not getting an explanation leaves people at risk of interpreting the rejection as a sign of their lack of value. Parents can help young people turn this around by assuring them that they have every right to get a kind and respectful explanation for the end of a relationship. If they don't, it's a sign of the rejector's shortcomings, evidence of a lack of emotional maturity and an inability to be caring. This understanding can be incorporated into their breakup story. An ex's bad behavior becomes a challenge to be surmounted. Young people will be better off with someone who can talk about conflicts, an attribute they can consciously seek when they're ready to move on. When to move on. Recovering from a breakup is rarely a neat process. It can circle in on itself, becoming endless and obsessive, past the point where thinking about what happened yields much insight. Teens may take to social media to vent, airing out grievances, either overtly or with passive-aggressive statements. They may become hyper-vigilant about what exes are posting and whether it looks like they're getting involved with someone new. The breakup becomes a problem teens can't stop thinking or talking about. Young people may believe they're helping themselves by cathartically letting their feelings out. In fact, non-stop ruminating keeps young people focused on how bad they feel and may lead them to impulsively try to reconnect with an ex. When this happens, young people will need to do the hard work of emotion regulation, exerting control over their state of mind and behaviors. Several experts told me that the first step should be, but often isn't, unfriending and unfollowing the ex on social media. This can feel extreme to teens. They believe it's mean, or an admission of vulnerability, of failure to play it cool. Their reluctance should be met with questions. How does seeing what the other person is doing online make you feel? Do you want to move forward? Or do you want to monitor the life of someone who no longer has much to offer you? Distractions help young people catch a break from obsessive thinking, physical exercise, baking, going out to a movie, even something as basic as taking a shower or going outside for a few minutes may provide a few moments or hours when an ex is not top of mind. After a short, days, not weeks, initial period of mourning, teens should be expected to keep up with school commitments and activities. They should be encouraged to nurture other close social ties, spending time with friends in ways that don't always involve conversations about the ex. Teens are quite susceptible to co-rumination. Past a certain point, a well-meaning friend's questions and indignation about the breakup may only inflame the hurt. If teens keep perseverating on what went wrong, encourage them to focus on specific, solvable problems, such as figuring out an after-school job schedule that avoids doing shifts with an ex, or how to return a bag of belongings. This may help young people regain a sense of control over their lives. Letting go. I saw the signs well in advance. My daughter's boyfriend had always been warm to my husband and me, and we enjoyed his presence in our home. Then his visits became less frequent. My daughter still saw him every afternoon at track practice, and I told myself maybe they were just going through a busy phase. Then, at a home meet, I saw him. He greeted me brightly, but he avoided my eyes, and I knew I would miss him, a feeling that many parents, I found, experience after a breakup. Sometimes they mourn the loss more than their children do. But when he broke up with my daughter, protective feelings overrode my wistfulness. At first, my daughter seemed okay. She huddled with a friend, plowing their way through a plastic sack of drugstore candy. She did her homework. At bedtime, she finally let me in. She'd been turning away from my touch for months. But that night, I lay down next to her and put my arms around her. We stayed that way for a long time, both of us unable to sleep. Since then, I've heard versions of this story more times than I can count. Parents holding weeping children for hours in residence halls or lying on a child's unmade bed, surrounded by used Kleenex or sunken into the family sectional while shooing curious younger siblings out of the room. These hours are difficult because our children's pain pains us, and their pain seems without end. I'm grateful my daughter accepted my soothing, a parent's original superpower. I said the same thing my mother said to me when my first relationship ended. This will pass. There's a book that accompanies this article. First Love, Guiding Teens Through Relationships and Heartbreak. And it's by Lisa A. Phillips. It's $25 at Amazon and $25 at bookshop.org. This next article is in Wholeness. How to Achieve Self-Acceptance at Last. Calling all perfectionists, the true path to loving yourself sometimes involves failing. This article is by Jennifer King Lindley. Have your New Year's resolutions already fizzled out? Here's a radical idea. Before you beat yourself up and try again, pause and consider why you think you needed an overhaul in the first place. Too often, the need to fix ourselves comes from a place of feeling like we are not good enough, says Ellen Hendrickson, PhD, a clinical psychologist at Boston University's Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders. As she explains in her new book, How to Be Enough, we come by our feelings of inadequacy honestly. We're inundated by the echoes of demanding parents, the funhouse mirrors of social media, and our consumer culture's insistence that we are just a potion or app away from finally measuring up. But this nagging belief that we are deeply flawed creates a wobbly foundation for real growth. A missed workout day or deadline confirms our suspicions, so we abandon our goals in defeat. As a therapist at Boston University, Hendrickson works with many clients dealing with the consequences of holding themselves to unreasonable standards. The rewards of perfectionism are many: praise, pride, promotions. But perfectionism works until it doesn't, she says. Over time, it might show up as realizing you have drifted apart from your spouse because you've had your nose to the grindstone for so long. It could surface as mental health problems like depression or chronic dissatisfaction. If I'm working so hard, why do I feel like a failure? Several years ago, Hendrickson began to recognize such unhealthy attitudes in herself. I was starting to burn out. It manifested physically. I developed a stress-related GI issue. I needed physical therapy after so much typing. I couldn't move my neck. it was a wake-up call, she says. Hendrickson realized that, like lots of the strivers she treats, she needed to adopt a new way, cultivating greater self-acceptance. Dropping the straitjacket of self-criticism frees you to take risks, and that's when real growth is possible. Accepting our imperfect self may paradoxically help quell our anxiety and loneliness, too. It is authenticity and vulnerability that foster real connection, she says. Of course, you don't gain this kind of self-acceptance overnight. It is a process, as Hendrickson explains in her book. We asked her how to begin the journey, and she suggested these steps. Embrace the exceptions. Harsh self-critics often engage in all-or-nothing thinking, says Hendrickson. Every presentation, every project, every social interaction can be a referendum on your value. I am either excellent 100% of the time, or I suck. Instead, shift to both-and thinking, she advises. Try her version of Mad Libs and fill in the blanks next time you don't live up to your own impossible standards. I'm a smart person, and I sometimes get answers wrong. I'm a caring mom, and I can still lose my temper at the end of a long day. Learning to accept such contradictions means we can keep an overall positive view of ourselves while still learning to tolerate life's inevitable bleeps and bloops. Find your way. We often obsess over achieving a flawless result as a way to prove our worth. But mistakes are normal and key to growing, says Hendrickson. Take your first stab at knitting, for example. If your debut scarf looks like an ungroomed golden doodle, take a step back and contemplate your bigger purpose here, Hendrickson suggests. Ask yourself, why am I making this? Maybe it's to learn to relax into a mindful activity or to explore your creativity. Focusing on your big picture values will make you much more tolerant of inevitable wobbles and help you move toward what is really important to you. Act with self-compassion. Hendrickson is a staunch believer in the power of treating yourself with the same kindness you would a friend. But it can be hard, she's found. As somebody with perfectionistic standards, when I tried to talk to myself like a good friend, I expected myself to spout the steady stream of articulate, self-compassionate hype and believe it instantly. When I inevitably couldn't do it, I despaired. Oh my God, I can't even be nice to myself. I felt like I was gaslighting myself. Hendrickson suggests a hack that works for her. Start by doing, not saying. We have more control over our actions than our thoughts or feelings, she explains. This could mean ignoring my email to allow myself a few minutes to savor my coffee in peace. It could be permitting myself to skip the gym if I feel a cold coming on. It is turning towards yourself with kindness and asking, "What do I need right now?" Treating yourself like you are enough is a big step toward, at last, truly believing it. Parts of this article were edited due to time. We're over in the word of the week. Overstimulation, when you feel bombarded by everything, everywhere, all at once. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Overstimulation. You know, those days where everything feels overwhelming. The grocery store lights are blinding. Your sweater feels like sandpaper. And your kid's music recital is pure migraine fuel. The irritations pile so high that by the end of the day, just hearing your partner breathe makes you want to scream into your pillow. This scenario may transcend ordinary agita. It could be overstimulation. Overstimulation may feel like being bombarded by sounds, sensations, and stimuli, says Andrew Kahn, PSYD, a licensed psychologist who specializes in ADHD, autism spectrum disorder, and anxiety. In certain situations, your nervous system can freak out from too much input, he says, triggering your body's fight or flight mode. cue overheating, hyperventilating, heart palpitations, the works. It's extremely uncomfortable and can lead to high levels of distress, Khan says. Everyone's experiences are different. Neurodivergent people, especially those with ADHD or autism, have a harder time filtering out stimuli, Khan says, so they can be more easily triggered by a passing fire truck or too bright commercial. Others have a higher threshold. If this happens to you, Khan recommends trying to anticipate triggers and getting ahead of them when possible, like wearing noise-canceling headphones while shopping. For those moments when you're caught off guard, ground yourself with some deep breathing. It's a simple way to turn your overstimulation into plain old stimulation. We've moved over into the lifestyle section. Is it forced forgiveness or real forgiveness? When we try to get over it and move on before we're truly ready, that's when things go sour. This article is by Isabel Burton. When wronged, we are often told that forgiveness is the best bet for restoring happiness, that absolving anger and disappointment will release you from being a prisoner to your own bitterness and let you merrily move on. And to be sure, forgiveness is great in principle and has a documented ripple effect that benefits mental health and physical well-being. But the wholesale advice to just let it go simplifies a complex issue and assumes that this so-called easy action will be a fast panacea for pain. The truth is, healing from being hurt takes time, and forgiving too quickly can cut short the process, says Lynn Saladino, PSYD therapist in New York, who is experienced in helping patients build skills to handle setbacks and move forward. Feeling harmed, fooled, sad, angry, it's all awful, she says. It makes sense that you'd want to get out of that state, but fast forgiveness doesn't erase those things. Those are human conditions, and while it's not fun, you need to brave through them to come to a place where you can eventually calm them down. Let's take stock. Your heart, trust, beliefs, something has been broken, and saying, no worries, all good, we're cool, too flippantly, can diminish that, can also cause you to misdirect or bury anger that would otherwise serve you, explains Saladino. Harnessing your rage at, say, being taken advantage of by a friend or cheated on by a partner can be a powerful way to restore your dignity and uphold self-respect, helping you make it through the mess confidently rather than feeling raw and ripped apart. Add on the fact that when we say bygones prematurely, we often end up layering pain on top of pain, she continues. You think, I did the right thing and cleared the air with this person, yet I'm still fuming. So now you have an even bigger burden, feeling like you've gone back on your word and that you're incapable of letting go of a grudge. Forgiving someone is hard no matter what, and doing so successfully entails waiting until you are truly ready to make amends. So how do you know when that moment has come? Saladino suggests four questions to ask yourself that bring clarity and help you avoid faking forgiveness. How do I even define forgiveness? Before anything, get clear on what you're actually asking of yourself. There are many interpretations of what forgiveness actually is, points out Saladino. It doesn't necessarily mean letting someone off the hook. Maybe forgiveness to you is freedom from letting the person or their crime monopolize your thoughts. Or it's deciding that while an ugly chunk of your past will never evaporate with an apology, you're open to finding a way to maneuver around it. If you can come to a definition that feels like a relief to you, then Saladino encourages you to move forward. Can I on-ramp? Forgiveness is not all or nothing. You don't decide to bury the hatchet and poof, done. It's a much longer process, says Saladino. There are steps to go through with a lot of untangling of mixed emotions, meaning you don't need to hurdle to complete resolution. But are you game to take a first step in that direction? That might include trying to see the story from your offender's point of view or agreeing to listen to their reasoning. There will be lingering scars, Saladino reminds us. Acknowledging them and still inching along is progress, even if it doesn't end in total forgiveness. What would a newly defined relationship look like? There's a misconception that once you make peace, you can and should act as if nothing ever happened. In truth, there's slim chance you'll actually forget about being burned and pretending to isn't going to do you any good. You have more information now about the capacity of that person, and you should use that information to safeguard yourself and redefine your relationship, explained Saladino, which bodes well for your future together. When you're able to shift the dynamic and evolve your union to the current reality, you'll be in a much healthier place than building back on a shoddy foundation. Remember, forgiving someone may include loss of some things you two once held dear. Is that okay? Or it may necessitate some protection, like not going near certain flammable situations. If you can find happiness in the picture of this remodeled relationship, you are ready. Am I truly doing this for myself? Sometimes mending the fence is a gift that we give. And when the other person is begging for it, it can be hard to assess our real motives. If you're being pressured, then you may not be ready. On the other hand, forgiving to lessen resentment's grip on you can be a positive driver. Consider how much impact the breach has on your daily life, says Saladino. Are you changing your routine to avoid someone or something? Are little reminders regularly opening the wounds? Are you waiting for an admittance of guilt from someone who will never own up? Take a really honest assessment of where you are with this. And if forgiving means no longer suffering and removing your own anger, it's time to start the process. Here are some book suggestions for books that reimagine Black history. Harlem Rhapsody by Victoria Christopher Murray. The award-winning author of First Ladies and the Personal Librarian once again uses fiction to illuminate the very real life of a trailblazing yet underappreciated Black woman, this time evoking Jessie Redmond Fawcett, a French-speaking cultural tastemaker of the Harlem Renaissance. Often celebrated as the literary midwife of the era, Fawcett discovered and nurtured the careers of luminaries such as Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston, Nella Larson, and County Cullen. Yet beneath her professional achievements lies an open secret. Her affair with civil rights activist W.E.B. Du Bois, a married man 14 years her senior. Murray's novel opens in 1919 as Jessie becomes the first female literary editor at The Crisis, a position created for her by Du Bois. Her editorial talent transforms the magazine into a symbol of Black literary excellence, yet her successes are overshadowed by rumors of her relationship with Du Bois, highlighting the unique challenges Black women faced with racism, sexism, and personal scrutiny. Rich in vibrant imagery, Murray's writing transports readers to a time when literature, music, and intellectual peacocking painted a stark picture of the who's who during the Negro movement of the 1920s. She also captures Fawcett's inner struggles and indomitable spirit, offering readers a vivid portrait of a woman who shaped the Harlem Renaissance while wrestling with her own desires and societal constraints. This is by Keishel Williams. So this book, Harlem Rhapsody, is by Victoria Christopher Murray. It's $20 at Amazon, $27 at bookshop.org, and $20 at Walmart. Next book suggestion is Black in Blues by Imani Perry. The National Book Award winning author of South to America takes us on another lyrical journey through history in this exploration of the mystery of blue and its alchemy in the lives of Black folk. She begins inside her grandmother's Alabama bedroom. meditating on how its blue walls could shelter the family from the harshness of the Jim Crow world outside. From there, Perry sweeps across place, time, and mood. She shows joy mixing with anguish and traditional blues music, the humor of the wily blue jay trickster reporting white folk evil to the devil, and the spiritual link between enslaved people in the New World and their Congolese ancestors, who wore similar blue amulets. Each impressionistic chapter carries us into a distinctive, colorful world, and together the sections weave a cultural richness that no traditional history could achieve. While Perry is a renowned Harvard academic who grounds her explorations in scholarship, here she feels more like our private guide for a vast cultural voyage, her voice beautifully echoing those of her muses, Toni Morrison and Zora Neale Hurston, by composing a story that unifies many generations of Black history and is experienced through a single color. Perry herself becomes a master blues artist. And these comments are by Eric Gleiberman. So the book, Imani, is by Imani Perry, I-M-A-N-I, and it's called Black in Blues. It's $25 at Amazon, $27 at bookshop.org, and $26 at Walmart. We have another recommendation, I Am Nobody's Slave by Lee Hawkins. In this unflinching memoir, Pulitzer Prize finalist and former Wall Street Journal writer Lee Hawkins traces his brutal family history back through the Jim Crow and slavery eras to understand how cumulative racial injury links to his childhood experience of domestic violence. Though Hawkins grew up in a supportive and tight-knit Minneapolis-St. Paul Black community, behind closed doors, his parents imposed stifling rules and physically abused their children in a trauma-driven attempt to protect them from white America's threats. Hawkins explores social science research on how trauma can be passed between generations as he uncovers deep personal wounds revealed in family archives. The journey he shares is one of compassion, and in building a healing dialogue with his father, Hawkins models one paved path troubled families might take to break the harmful cycle. This article is by E.G. I Am Nobody's Slave by Lee Hawkins is $23 at Amazon. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.